Transportation and Modal Subcommittee will now come to order. Margarita, please call the roll.
Chair McFarland.
Here.
Vice Chair Baker.
Here.
Ranking Member Hinson.
Here.
Representatives Andrade, Arrington.
Here.
Bankson.
Here.
Fairfield.
Here.
Edmonds. Escamani. Esposito.
Here.
Harris.
Here.
Lopez. Mello.
Here.
Michael.
Here.
Nixon.
Here.
Porras. Smith.
Here.
Stark.
Here.
Quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Margarita. Let the record show that a quorum is present. And members, before we begin, and members of the audience, if you could please silence your electronic devices. We're going to have a great meeting today, folks. Today is Advanced Air Mobility Day here in the Transportation Subcommittee. Advanced Air Mobility promises to be the future of transportation in Florida, and I feel like we say that often in this subcommittee, but this one's going to be cool today. We have a number of participants here, both virtually and in person, and the members that you see before you presenting to us today, committee members, are members of the Advanced Air Mobility Working Group, which the Florida Department of Transportation convened. These folks have been working together with an eye on Florida and what we can do to bring this transportation, bring this mode of transportation to Florida when it's ready. I will preface everything by saying that we don't have these aircraft commercially available for you and I today. It's coming very soon. We'll hear from several industry partners that will have aircraft available soon, but they are not in the air today for you and I to ride on. But it's coming. With that, I'll just introduce our members here. We have Kim Holland, who is the Assistant Secretary of Strategic Development from FDOT, with here in person. Yep, thank you. Rolando Tapanez from Ferrovial Vertiport. Ferrovial builds the infrastructure, not the aircraft, or on the infrastructure side for a term called Vertiport, which we'll learn more about. Ferrovial is partnering with Lilium, which is an aircraft manufacturer, with some deployments in Florida. We'll hear a little bit more about that. We have JC Asensio from Wisk Aero. Wisk is a California-based company, and they are recently a subsidiary of Boeing, so congratulations. And then virtually, we have Matt Brofman, who looks like he's in a Lilium aircraft. Hello, Matt. Lilium is a German-based company, and they have an exciting Lake Nona deployment on track for, I think, 2025, in partnership with Ferrovial, who I mentioned. Also virtually, we have Robert Freiba with Volocopter. Volocopter is another German-based company. They excitingly have a test flight scheduled for later this fall in Tampa. We have George Kvork from Joby Aviation. Joby is California-based company, but they have aircraft deployments on some of our Air Force bases here in Florida. From Skyports Infrastructure Online, I think we have just one. Do we have two, Skyport? Yep, okay, great. We have Paul Brooks and Philip Brady from Skyports. Now, Skyports is not an aircraft. They're on the infrastructure side. They're a vertiport manufacturer. Philip, I believe, lives in Orlando. I think you have some of your representatives on the panel here. Skyport is London-based, but they've worked very carefully on a concept of operation between Miami International Airport and Miami Convention Center. And then also online, we have Beta Technologies, which is a Vermont-based company. They make an aircraft, and they have partnerships with Eglin Air Force Base. And I think I've got everyone. I've asked Mr. Brofman from Lilium to just give us an industry 101. This is not a specific Lilium pitch. It's just to help us understand what the market looks like. So, Mr. Brofman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair McFarland. Thank you, committee members. We are incredibly excited to share with you the progress that we've been making globally across the country and here in Florida. I think the interest that you see from all of the OEMs and our industry partners and infrastructure partners is due to the great leadership that we have here in Florida, the great conditions that we have to be able to operate in from an economic standpoint and from a regulatory standpoint. And we're really excited to continue that. I want to apologize to myself, and I know a number of our colleagues, we would love to be there in person. I know a few of us are at the NBAA conference, the National Business Aviation Conference, which is coincidentally happening this week out on the West Coast. Hopefully we'll have it back in Florida in no time, and we'll make these type of calendar collisions a little bit easier. I'm going to try to share my screen here. This is, as Chair McFarland mentioned, this is an industry overview. One of the great things, and I know I speak for all my colleagues about our industry, is how well we all work together. We will, compete with the aircraft, with the different types of operations, with our commercial business model and our strategy. But our hope is to not compete on policy, right? We want to make the US and Florida in particular a place where the AAM industry can thrive. And so we are here today as kind of a unified front to share with you a little bit about us and our overview. So we're going to highlight really some of the different ways that we are all going to market, so you'll understand the nuances and differences, even though, again, what we're ultimately all asking for is the same thing, which is the ability to operate in Florida. So the first is really business model. So there's three kind of distinct business models. The first two on the passenger side, urban air mobility, which is really what we think about as kind of the air taxis. This is a replacement for, shorter term intra-city transportation. So within an urban population, getting from one side to another. The second is regional air mobility. This is connecting our cities across Florida. So think Orlando to Tampa, Orlando to Gainesville, Miami to the Keys, right? Being able to connect from city to city. And then cargo and medical, right, which can span both urban and regional, but this idea of not necessarily having to transport passengers, but transporting either cargo or critical organ or medical supplies. Another way that, again, the AAM industry will go to market is likely through the type of service offerings. So the kind of three ways to think about that. One is on demand. So this, think more, Uber, Lyft, kind of the existing rideshare, where you will say, I am here, and I want to have a ride from this point to point B, and the app will tell you exactly where to go when your aircraft will arrive. The second is scheduled. This is very similar to the way that we see existing airline operations today, right? There'll be a scheduled service of there's a flight from here to here at this time. You buy a ticket on that flight, and you have a seat waiting for you. And the third is charter. And so this, again, is something we see in the aviation industry today, which is where the customer will then request oftentimes a whole charter where they'll say, I want an aircraft for me to go on from this point to this point. And they might bring their family, their colleagues, or just themselves, depending on the scenario, to charter that aircraft since the customer dictates it. These are important distinguishing points from an FAA perspective, and just useful to know as we think about the different ways that AAM will come to market in Florida. And the third is really who's operating these vehicles also varies, right? So when we think OEM, which is original equipment manufacturer, that's those of us that are here as my colleagues in the AAM industry that are non-infrastructure, really we're OEMs for the most part. And so some OEMs are going to operate their own aircraft. They'll have a Part 135, which is the certificate they'll receive from the FAA to operate the aircraft within a given network. You'll have the OEM's brand on that. So, Archer, Joby, Volocopter, and Wisk have all announced intentions to do just that. You'll also have what is really more that traditional airline model where there's somebody who produces an aircraft and sells it to an airline, and the airline then operates that under their own brand and relationship. Again, on this side, we've got Archer, Beta, Eve, Lilium, and Volocopter, and Wisk. And you'll notice, again, not everybody is in just one box, right? Because the aircraft can be used in different forms and functions. And third and kind of finally is really private sales. So this is, again, more like the general aviation, traditional general aviation marketplace today, where aircraft are sold and managed through a private fractional management company, for private use. And so Lilium is engaging in that practice today. So I think really, and Chairman Farland highlighted this, right? There are not today aircraft flying in Florida. So we wanted to provide you a very realistic view or what we believe is a very realistic view of when we see this coming to market. I won't read through all of these bullet points, but essentially 25 to 27 is kind of this crawl phase where we see, you know, low cadence of operations happening between vertiports and really leveraging existing infrastructure. When we say existing infrastructure, I mean existing, you know, helipads and heliports, existing airports that most of our aircraft will be able to take off and land at. 28 to 30, right, that cadence gets built up. This becomes more of what we think about those commuter operations, where there be a higher level of demand. And third and finally, right, was 2030 plus, where we see really those full scale, comparable commercial aviation operations. You'll notice we have autonomous in here because one of our OEMs that is actually in the room with you all today is building an autonomous aircraft. For the most part, the rest of us all have piloted aircraft, commercially piloted aircraft. And so it's important to note that, you know, that is a common feature. Again, we think autonomy for all of us eventually will be great. We're super excited that WISC is really paving the groundwork to bring that to market as well.
Mr. Brofman, if I could just interrupt real quick.
Yes.
I'm not sure if your slides are hanging. If you could just advance your slides. We're still on the business model slide.
I'm going to reset the share and we'll try that.
While he's taking a pause, members, I've handed out to each of you a printout with the pictures of each of the aircraft. I know a lot of us are visual learners and it might help to picture each of these companies' aircraft as we hear from them today. And you can imagine these things flying us to Tallahassee with greater ease.
All right. Hopefully this is working a little bit better.
That's great, Mr.
Brofman. Thank you. Let me know. So I think it's important to touch on the benefits, right? These are incredibly cool aircraft. We're incredibly excited to bring them to Florida, but there are key benefits to the AAM aircraft. They are all electric, so that means zero operating emissions. Safety is incredibly important. There are fewer moving parts to all of our aircraft than there would be in a traditional aircraft out there. Just to put that in comparison, for some of our aircraft, the amount of parts, total parts that you have in the aircraft is equal to that you'd have in the landing gear of a traditional jet, right? So just to compare, again, that means, you know, less opportunities for failure, less moving parts. And we've seen this on the ground-based EV. Anybody who has a ground-based EV knows that maintenance required on ground-based EV is much less, and that's because you just have less moving parts. That increases safety as well. Noise, a lot of the helicopter market in the U.S. has really struggled to be as successful as it has been in some other countries, and a lot of it has to do with the noise impact on communities from helicopters. I know personally, I live not far from a few helipads that get used for tourism purposes in Florida, and it is certainly not something that neighborhoods are a huge fan of. And so we're excited that as we bring our aircraft into market in Florida, the communities will get to understand exactly how quiet these aircraft are, and that will allow us to take advantage of a lot of facilities that helicopters today can't. And due to removing fuel, due to the fewer moving parts, similar to that of, again, the ground-based EVs, the electric aircraft will be cheaper to operate and maintain than traditional aircraft, which really helps with that scale as we bring this to the mass market. So hopefully the slide advances here and you will see the, although I see it not, so let me do this one more time because this is the important slide. So this is an overview of all of our various aircraft for the folks that are in the room and on the call that are doing work in Florida to some extent. Just to give you again, they all look slightly different. They all have different forms and functions. They all have different types of rotors and the way that they function. But on here is also the certification, the planned certification time for each of the different aircraft, some of the business model speed and range that really gives you the sense of kind of the different flavors of aircraft. I won't walk through each of them because we could all talk for 30 minutes and tell you exactly why ours is slightly different and slightly better. But we're super excited about the varying aircraft that are out there and how that will really allow for different business models, different mission profiles, and different ways of bringing benefit to the state of Florida. And finally, the supporting ecosystem that comes around this, I think it's, you know, we're excited that Skyports and Ferrovial have been fantastic partners in Florida from a policy perspective and from a commercial perspective to bring these to market. But there's also, you know, I imagine that in 10 years, this slide will be, you know, littered with logos and different things that are surrounding services for this new industry. But right now we want to highlight, you know, there's the platforms and charter brokers. The way that you book the ride will essentially be business opportunities that we will see people, existing players and new players playing in. Charging is obviously key and crucial. We are working, you know, with airports across the state of Florida to ensure, and existing facilities to ensure charging is available there. And they'll be just like we have for ground-based vehicles, a variety of different options. Maintenance and training providers, and then operating technology as we, again, scale operations that will be needed. So that was our very brief overview of the AAM industry and where we're at. And I know towards the end, Chair, we are more than happy to take any questions either as an industry or individually about what we're doing. But again, thank you for your leadership putting this together. We're super excited to be here in Florida and to do this work in Florida.
Thank you, Mr. Brofman. That was helpful, I hope, members, to just give us a level set of what the industry looks like. We'll turn now to Ms. Holland, who I'll say her title again, Assistant Secretary of Strategic Development for FDOT. So she's one of ours, member of the working group, and I thought it would be helpful to hear from DOT's perspective as we head into session. A little bit of a readout from the working group. And members, if questions come to you, I think today we'll save our questions to the end. We're not gonna hear from each panel members individually, but they're all here to answer our questions, and so is Ms. Holland. So we'll save our questions to the end, but feel free to, you know, make a note and save your spot for after. Ms. Holland, you are recognized.
Can you hear me? Okay. So, Chair, thank you very much, and also Vice Chair Baker. It's my pleasure to be here and be speaking with you today and to talk about the great work that the Florida Department of Transportation has been doing on the emerging industry of advanced air mobility. Back in 2021, the FDOT launched the Advanced Air Mobility Working Group, and this has engaged industry leaders, our aviation experts, representatives from all levels of government, and also multimodal partners across the state. So as we're working to navigate the next steps of implementation, we are working to maintain our global position in this market and also hold on to our established record of air traffic transportation. So today, I want to explain what is AAM, the leading role that the department has taken, and also some next steps that are ahead of us. So the department has taken a leading role in integrating advanced air mobility into Florida's diverse transportation portfolio beginning back in 2021. So a couple of terms that you're going to hear. So advanced air mobility, AAM, that's an air transportation system that's primarily utilizing eVTOL aircrafts. It's moving people, it's moving goods, and it's providing services in both urban and regional settings. The eVTOL, that's the electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. And then when we're looking at those urban and those regional settings, the urban air mobility, or UAM, that stands for the intra-city setting. And a great example of that type of movement could be from a sports entertainment venue to a local airport. When we're looking at the regional air mobility, so that's RAM, this is our intercity setting, and a great example would be a hospital to a hospital transfer. It's also important to note that the AAM market is expected to reach $1 trillion nationally by 2040. So why have the eVTOLs become an alternative to traditional helicopters? Through AAM, it has been possible to advance those distributed electric propulsion systems, and this has really enabled the electric vehicle aircrafts to advance in this market. So very similar to electric vehicles, the electrification of the engine allows for almost immediate response when accelerating and decelerating, and it also allows for high energy output during takeoff and enhanced control during landings. So there's a number of different types of eVTOLs, and one of the first examples is this multi-copter. It looks and it flies like a helicopter, except that there's multiple rotors. We also have the lift and cruise vehicle. This uses rotors for that vertical lift, and then it transitions to propellers for the horizontal flight. And then the vector thrust vehicle uses rotors and fans for both vertical and horizontal flight. So through the current development cycle, the design and the battery technology advancements will help to progress the travel distance and also the passenger load capability. So generally, as we discuss advanced air mobility, we tend to think of this through the personal transportation aspect. So like that Uber in the sky. However, this technology has the potential to ease congestion and also increase our supply chain resiliency. These vehicles have the ability to deliver medical goods, household items, and also time-sensitive cargo. The applications in public service have yet to be fully realized, but they're anticipated to aid first responders with life-saving search and rescue, disaster relief, air ambulance operations, such as medevac. So as we make great strides in progressing the advanced air mobility industry in Florida, we're continuing to see growing interest. We're also continuing to see support from our public and also our private partners across the state. Our state is so proud to lead the nation as we also continue to innovate. So we're looking to the future. We're anticipating what this industry is going to look like as the technology continues to advance. So initially, these vehicles will be flown by pilots. They will be all electric. They will use traditional flight controls. They'll follow traditional air traffic control management rules, and they will also be low frequency and low volume capacity. When we're looking to those futuristic innovations, it could allow for autonomous operations, alternative fuel cells, the utilization of an air traffic system that's developed uniquely for advanced air mobility, and having the potential to be a major transportation tool in Florida's landscape. So Florida understood how critical this industry could become to the state of Florida. And with an industry early in its infancy, stakeholders had been asking questions, they were looking for guidance, and FDOT has been proactive. FDOT has taken a critical role to solidify Florida's place as a top leader in advanced air mobility implementation. We are so thankful to have a working group, and back in the 2021 timeframe, those relevant questions were brought up, and great excitement was also brought to the table. Our working groups include airports. So our working group members include airports, airport authorities, cargo and logistic members. It has included a member of the FAA, higher educational institutions, local transportation partners, municipalities. From that perspective, the Florida Association of Counties and the Florida League of Cities have participated in this working group. It's also included our modal partners, that's transit, rail, seaports, and also spaceports. It's also included OEMs and industry partners and several statewide associations, such as the Florida Airports Council. I'd also like to take a moment to thank Representative Bankson and also Senator Harrell for their direct involvement and interest in advanced air mobility. So we have several working group members who are with us here in the audience today, and I'd like to ask you to raise your hand and be recognized. Thank you. So the working group has produced several documents that are guiding officials at all levels, and it's bringing focus to what lies ahead in the development of this industry. FDUT has built a foundation of knowledge to advance the industry. This has included the FDUT AAM roadmap. It's included the FDUT minimum standards and gap analysis and the FDUT airport compatibility considerations. All of these guiding documents are available on our external facing website, and you also have a copy of the roadmap in front of you today. So one of the work products produced by the working group is an implementation plan. The implementation plan walks through three important things. It includes regulatory, legislative, and also community outreach items, and all of these should be undertaken as the advanced air mobility landscape matures here in the state of Florida. At FDUT, steps are being taken to update the department's airport, airspace, and land use guidebook, and this is aiding in the introduction of the technology. When we look at the different phases, I want to first speak about phase one. So this includes our stakeholder outreach and also education. And there is no better format than to do that than today with our transportation and modal committee and also our Florida legislature. The elements of FDUT's public outreach plan include hosting tabletop exercises. It's enhancing the FDUT AAM website and also workshops with local decision makers to educate them about AAM. Phase two includes public education campaigns and community outreach, and these are helping to engage the public and to increase very important public awareness of this new emerging technology. So as you can see, both phase one and phase two are centered on our communities. Our communities and engagement with them is incredibly important. So as with any new technology, understanding and acceptance, it goes a long way. And especially as policymakers at all levels of government, the continuation of being able to produce a helpful framework for AAM to be successful helps with speaking with each of the unique communities across the state. We have provided a multitude of resources to ensure the implementation is done safely, efficiently, and with the citizens of our state at the forefront. Lastly, with phase three, this includes full integration into Florida's robust transportation network. It's increasing our supply chain resiliency and diversifying our multimodal system. So we have covered all the great progress that's being made across the state, but now let's talk about some hurdles that exist. So at a state level, we are taking all of the correct steps to engage with stakeholders, think through local ordinance requirements, and ensure safety is first and also foremost with our communities. As you see on the screen, there's a number of critical components that include regulations and guidance. These are pending from the federal government, and this is an impact beyond just the state, it's occurring nationally. So I'm going to talk a little bit about infrastructure design. So currently, the FAA guidance does not align with the FAA's heliport design. This is for general aviation and it's creating a confusing situation for simultaneous operation. It also does not include guidance on parking areas or instrument flight rules infrastructure guidance, and it does not include autonomous operation, and it further limits the development of the technology. When we're talking about aircraft certifications in the United States, the F-35B, the V-22 Osprey, and the Harrier jump jet, those are the only powered lift aircrafts with existing criteria. The emerging eVTOL, while also considered a power lift aircraft, does not have the approved certification criteria. This change requires a significant and a subsequent rule change to pilot training and certification. There is also no guidance for alternative powered aircrafts, including hydrogen. When we're looking at pilot training and certification, pilots are required to be type certified for each powered lift aircraft, making cross-training difficult and also highly skilled. There's also significant cost and time implications to get the 50 hours to qualify for each powered lift rating. There are also additional costs that require some aircrafts to be built with dual controls for flight training, so that's adding the instructor. And then there's additional rulemaking, which is adding potentially up to 2 years to the process. That's additional federal rulemaking. Lastly, in talking about air traffic integration, the FAA has not addressed the high-tempo operations in urban areas, the existing flight rules. It does not address autonomy or complex operations, and the FAA has not addressed air traffic separation and instrument flight rules operations, for example, in bad weather conditions. There has not been an outline plan to achieve a new performance-based air traffic management system, and this is often referred to as an uncrewed traffic management, or UTM. So I want to close by leaving you with this slide. So this technology is not something that we are anticipating to be here in 2050. This technology is here, and we are working to ensure it can be implemented. The OEMs have a more realistic entry to market in 2024, 2025. And as you may be aware, at Governor DeSantis's direction, the Department of Transportation Secretary Perdue, he sent a letter to both the USDOT and the FAA 2 weeks ago. It detailed the federal backlog challenges, and it encouraged them to finalize the remaining requirements. There are other countries out there outpacing the United States with this cutting-edge technology. So while we have manufacturers, employees, local governments, and businesses, they're all eagerly awaiting to take flight. I know that there's even conversations that are taking place in this body and discussing how Florida can be prepared to move swiftly following the federal government. With Florida government's role to create the framework for success for this emerging technology, the time is now. As many of you have heard Secretary Perdue discuss, communities are truly at the heart of everything that we do at DOT. The opportunity that advanced air mobility and what that market creates for a thriving state like Florida is the ability to capitalize on this emerging technology. It's reinforcing our supply chain, and it's making us more resilient for years to come. So, Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present today to the committee.
Thank you very much, Ms. Holland. Members, we've gotten a good preview here. I think I'll start us off in questions by, just for procedural, Ms. Holland, you're welcome to take your seat again. I think for our members who are joining us virtually and in person, If members direct a question to you specifically, go for it. If not, just indicate to me, and I'll recognize you to answer questions as they come. Ms. Holland, if you could just underscore again for us on the committee here, the state's role in regulation of advanced air mobility. So just for shorthand for myself, I've been thinking it that FAA regulates the aircraft. Our role in Florida is to make the infrastructure, so the vertiports or the airports, workforce, pilots, zoning, all of that is within our regulatory power and wheelhouse. But the aircraft regulation and airspace is up to the FAA. Do I have that right?
Very close. So the airspace is regulated by the FAA, the pilot training and certification, and then also the vehicle certification will be managed by the FAA. Local ordinances and zoning and the application for the vertiport infrastructure, the FDOT will provide that approval.
Ms. Holland, as you met with some of our local government partners, you mentioned League of Cities and Association of Counties was part of the working group. What were some of the concerns that you heard from local governments when it comes to receiving both aircraft and the vertiports in their municipalities?
One of the biggest concerns was public information and elevating awareness. Also, it's those local municipalities working through their guidance and what their local ordinances and what their zoning may look like. The department has a number of tools that are available, and we're happy to work with any of those local governments to walk them through that process.
And maybe Skyports or Ferrovial, if you guys would like to weigh in as well. Again, these are our participants today who are on the infrastructure side of the conversation.
Well, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity. Philip, sorry that I'm going to jump ahead of you, but I know that you'll wrap it up as effectively as you always do. Well, I think it's so exciting that we're here. Both Ferrovial and Skyports, as we have heard from Ms. Holland, have been working collaboratively with the state. Ferrovial is very excited to invest its money, capital, and knowledge as a worldwide leader in airport and infrastructure construction to bring this first-of-its-kind kind of technology to Florida. And as we just heard in Ms. Holland's closing, the time is now, and we're in full support of the implementation of FDOT's Advanced Air Mobility Working Group recommendations. We think that they are balanced and that they will give local governments the guidance they need to then be able to fit this into the fabric of each respective community without being additional hurdles or trappings to allow each community to decide what they want. So wonderful to be here, and FDOT has done a wonderful job.
Mr. Brady, if you'd like to weigh in, you're recognized.
I would fully support everything Ferrovial said. You know, Skyports, based in London, have projects all over the world, been doing this for quite some time now. You know, we believe Florida as a state is as well, if not better positioned than any other state in the union, and arguably most of the first markets that we will see AAM, you know, globally. So we are here, we will go where the OEMs and operators are interested in flying, and have positioned ourselves to date to, you know, hit the ground running when the time is right. We support FDOT and everything they've done to date. They've set a great kind of standard. And, you know, I think this, if the state moves forward with this implementation, you know, could set a pathway for other states to follow. So.
Ms. Warburg, did I see a hand from you as well? Did you want to weigh in? No. All right, members, let's open it up for any questions. Ranking Member Hinson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the great presentation. I do believe I had an one-on-one about these heliports last year. Is that possible? Yes, it is. Okay, thank you for that. So What kind of infrastructure investment will taxpayers have to invest in setting these up in the different communities?
Ms. Holland, you want to start? You're recognized.
I'm happy to start. So the majority of the vertiports that are being evaluated, they're being built with private investment and also private development. And then the share on the Department of Transportation side is the review of those applications.
Excellent. Excellent.
For a follow-up, you're recognized.
Thank you so much. It's very exciting what you're saying. I see from your picture there's only like four passengers. What economies of scale exist for ordinary passengers like me? I'm not rich.
You're recognized, Mr. Sethia.
Thank you so much again for this opportunity. Again, we're from Wisk Aero, a Boeing subsidiary, also focused on autonomy as well. And I just want to say we plan to manufacture and operate these aircraft. And from that perspective, right, we really look to enable scalability as soon as possible to ensure that more communities have access to aviation and at more accessible prices. And so we see developing this workforce pipeline of pilots and also autonomy are key drivers for us to enable that as soon as possible.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Edmonds, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's funny because last session, the first day of committee, I was wondering if we were ever going to talk about flying cars, and now we're here. So this question is really for anybody. It's really about the data. So when I think about autonomous cars, they're collecting data on people who are crossing the roads, if there are any animals in the road, and they use that data. They collect it to make it more efficient. When we're talking about eVTOLs, if that's the proper word for it, since they have a bird's eye view, they can see everything. What type of data points are they collecting, and is that data being shared to any other type of companies for usage?
I'll open that up to some of our OEMs. Mr. Kevork, you're recognized.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. That's a great question. The industry, although what's great about this is, unlike rideshare, which just showed up, we're dealing with aviation, right? So we've spent the last decade or more working on this and developing the technology and developing the information. Many of the companies you're seeing on the call now have spent the last several years as well. Similarly, I can speak just specific to Joby as examples. We've been working directly with the DoD, for example, to do a lot of our flight testing where that information is collected and provided back to them. The FAA is now going to be working with the Air Force Agility Prime program to start also getting that shared that data and information about the safety of the aircraft, the maneuvers, the procedures, the operations, et cetera. Joby delivered its first commercial production line aircraft to the Edwards Air Force Base in California, where it's conducting daily flight testing. We've actually been operating in Marina, California, up in the Central Coast for the last 3-4 years, where we fly every day and sort of have the full-scale aircraft doing flights. What's great about this is you're seeing NASA, FAA, and the industry, and Agility Prime and DoD come together to put together this information as it becomes valuable for the industry to put it forward for operational launch. So we've got a lot of learnings that we've put together over the years, in addition to the existing, obviously, aviation infrastructure that is out there. So really have a lot of value in putting forth a very safe product and making sure that what comes to the community, both in terms of noise, in terms of safety, in terms of understanding of aircraft, is something that they're going, you know, they're comfortable with and familiar with, just like when they step on an, you know, another Southwest flight or another Delta flight. You know, they're not questioning whether when that plane was built and who built it, but having the validity of the FAA and the validity of the industry behind it. So hopefully that answered some of that question.
You're recognized, Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be honest, that did not answer my question. Because when we look at even cars, they know how much their passengers weigh. So I'm sure there's very specific data points that you all may be collecting. But to move forward, could a private corporation, let's say Google, could they buy the data information that you all are using to make it more efficient so they can sell tickets for your particular passengers? Or could any private company buy your data points?
I love that data privacy is part of this conversation here today. Do any of the OEMs want to speak to the data sharing practices, perhaps currently or in the future? Or maybe data collection points, I think.
Yeah,
collection and then sharing. Shockingly, no.
Chair, I'm happy to jump in.
Mr. Brafman, you're recognized.
So I think an important key here is the operators of all of these aircraft will be governed by existing FAA regulations. So at launch, Part 135 operators, which I know sounds like a number, but it's essentially the same way that you operate charter flights today across the country. The avionics systems that are in most of our aircraft, especially the ones that are launching early, are traditional avionics equipment that you'd see in any other type of aircraft. Some of them are newer models, they're more sophisticated, the higher technology. But we're not, these are not, the intention here is not to generate tons of data for data collection purposes, right? As a matter of fact, if anything, it's the opposite. The weight of an aircraft is very sensitive for all of us. And so the things and avionics and technology that goes in the aircraft is only the things that are needed. Now, to date, we will collect data on obviously where passengers go, come and go, their origin and destination, what operators do with that, you know, no different than what American Airlines or Southwest Airlines or any charter operator does today. I think the interesting part is we are all working together and with communities and states to understand what data will be, making sure that communities are aware of what data will be available. Because today you can track aircraft regardless of their desire. You can track aircraft all across the country. And so if a community wants to know who's operating in their jurisdiction, where are they going, where are they coming from, that data is available to them. I can, you know, speak for Lilium, for example, there's not a camera that is outside of our aircraft looking at anything. There's no gathering data that is out there. Obviously, as we move to full autonomy, right, there will be more data elements that are as part of that. But I'm unaware of anyone's intention of using that data other than to optimize operations, right? That's not the business model that we are in. You know, I can't obviously speak for and promise for any future operator and what they're doing. That's certainly not why we're developing this aircraft. And I would actually say the opposite, as what George was pointing out is correct. We know that it is super important to build trust with the residents in our communities. And the way to do that is to ensure that we are being as privacy focused and sensitive as possible. And it would also be prudent for us to talk about the altitude by which most of us intend to fly is the altitude of that of general aviation, business aviation. So, you know, we love to think about, you know, flying cars and air taxis, and we all immediately, depending on our age, I think go to things like Jetsons. I'll go ahead and say it. And I think we ought to note that that's not what we're proposing here, right? These are aircraft that will be, you know, at appropriate altitudes as they fly over communities, as they fly over cities. Obviously, they will be taking off and landing, going to ground. But we are not, you know, we are very aware of and sensitive to the privacy issues and making sure the community is aware of what we're doing and what's being and where data is being collected and used.
Mr. Asensio from WIST, did you want to weigh in as well? You're recognized.
Yep, just want to completely agree with Brafman here. And from the autonomous perspective, right, we're going to need a wide array of sensors, both visually and non-visually. And we're purely focusing on utilizing that data for the safety of flight. So.
Representative Eskamani, did you have a question still?
Thank you so much, Chair. And I want to first to say thank you to all the panelists and a big thank you to Matt, who is the Orlandonian. So it's great to see you virtually from your spaceship. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so I was really curious. I've had some conversations about AMM over the years, specifically with our airport. So I'm curious, what has that partnership been so far with our airports? And then a quick follow-up to that. You know, obviously when airlines in Florida, you know, they pay a tax on jet fuel, which is a source of revenue for airports. So I'm curious, you know, my understanding is AMs are, you know, electronic, so there's no fuel costs. But I'm curious when it comes to taxes or fees, you know, what has been your experience in navigating this disruptor within the current infrastructure of revenue generators for municipalities and different public institutions like airports?
Ms. Holland, an answer for our Ways and Means Ranking Member.
Chair, thank you. And Representative, several very great questions in there. As it relates to the partnerships with our airports, many of our major hub airports are preparing for this technology. So whether that's including it in master planning or strategic planning or site selection documents, they're all getting ready for it. As it relates to the infrastructure for the electrification, they are all also preparing for that. It does require very important power systems for these vehicles. As far as the revenue goes, I don't have an incredible line of sight into their revenue models. Traditionally, at our major hub airports, their higher revenue generation is going to come from the commercial jets that you see today.
You're recognized.
Thank you so much. And I think that's a great question for the industry, which we're having that question with electric vehicles right now, too, not knowing the answer, if you will, to EVs since they're not using gas either. And obviously, we have some bills that will explore that topic, too, this session. But my final question is just right now, what is the cost for someone if they want to, for example, you know, fly from an airport into XYZ location? What's the average cost right now, and what's the goal with competition and expansion, scaling up? Like, what would be the ideal average cost, I guess, for someone who wants to take a ride somewhere?
Any of our OEM partners?
George, do you want to take that one? Yeah.
Yeah, at scale, thank you so much. At scale, we've talked about this being a commercial service that's available to the public. This is not meant to be exclusive. This is meant to be part of complementary into the transportation system. So the idea is, as you mentioned, you should be able to take this from from an airport to a, you know, transit-oriented stop or development area or a green field. But the concept would be that ultimately at scale, you're looking at $4 to $5 a mile for this. Obviously, when you know you have a handful of these aircrafts, that wouldn't be the pricing initially, just like an iPhone or a computer. But eventually, the goal is once you've got several of these nodes, several of these sort of takeoff landing locations within an airport, within an existing helipad, within maybe a new green site, you're looking at that rate for passenger travel. And for Joby, again, there's what's unique about all these aircrafts, they all have very specific models or designs or specifications that can allow for various types of service. For Joby, the idea is we want to take you on a 10-minute trip for a trip that normally should be taking 20 minutes and it's taking an hour. You'll be able to do that in an aircraft for about 10 minutes. So that's sort of the scale we're looking to address.
And Representative Lopez, you have a question? You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Assistant Secretary Holland. So as you look over the landscape of the communities that will be, you know, getting ready for 2024, 2025, 2026, as you know, I represent the urban area of Miami-Dade County. And curious, I've been doing a little research on the vertiports. And it says, you know, oftentimes they say they'll be 30 minutes away. In my community, 30 minutes is not where we want to be, right? In other words, I'm thinking I live on Brickell. It's, you know, the heart of Miami. I want to get to Miami Beach, or I want to get to North Miami. How feasible really are these vertiports for very dense communities where I would love to jump on one of these, you know, vehicles, if you will, to go from here, you know, from say my Brickell area to Aventura, which would be probably an hour and a half in a car. Wouldn't it be great if I could be there in 5 or 10 minutes? So I guess I'm curious how it's going to work looking at the environment of urban areas, right? You know, and maybe someone can explain for those of you that I'm sure have been looking at the Miami-Dade area as obviously a possible first, you know, kind of rollout. So if you could kind of help me with that, because I'm sure my constituents are going to want to know how this is all going to work. Thank you.
Maybe we'll start with Skyports. I know you guys have looked very carefully at the Miami-Dade. Mr. Brooks or Mr. Brady, if you'd like to take the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. So Brickell being a very dense and urban environment with a lot of skyscrapers, you have to understand each kind of built environment as it exists. And the likelihood of Brickell proper itself having a vertiport based on the height and existing development is pretty unlikely, but that doesn't mean Watson Island or, you know, another still close proximity location just out of the urban core of Brickell couldn't support a vertiport of some shape and size. You know, Aventura has plenty of locations, garages and kind of new development, office parks that could support a vertiport of, you know, some shape and size. Again, you know, do I see a vertiport going in downtown Brickell? Probably not because of the height and the density. But that doesn't mean Watson Island Heliport couldn't support a vertiport and an eVTOL, or Dodge Island with the Port Authority. So I think it's highly likely that, you know, North Miami, parts of Miami proper will have a vertiport, but there's also a NIMBYism aspect to it, right? So do the residents want this? And I think there will be neighborhoods throughout Florida, throughout every region, that residents just simply say, we do not want this. So I hope that answers the question. And by way of flight time, you're probably talking, once you're in the air, you know, 8 to 12 minutes max to get from Brickell to Aventura.
Mr. Tavenis, you recognize.
Not to steal Ms. Holland's thunder, I'll let you wrap up, because I know that she directed a question to her, but wanted to follow up on some of the things that Philip spoke to. I think it's important to highlight that these vertiports can be built on a very small footprint. So that will allow for it to be done in an urban setting. Like Philip said, maybe not in Brickell necessarily, but there might be other locations in or around downtown Miami that are adjacent to Brickell that would make it convenient for you to get there and then take, you know, an 8-minute ride to Aventura and still save an hour. Additionally, I think there's opportunities to redevelop other assets that maybe are being underutilized. There's been lots of discussion of being able to use the rooftop of municipal parking garages. And sometimes there's those possibilities. There's structural issues that have to be addressed, but those opportunities exist. And being from Miami as well, if you're talking about the Brickell area, being adjacent to the water also helps the operation of these aircraft. So whereas the height of buildings in Brickell, maybe in the core of it, is a limiter, if there's a property that's near the bay, that would maybe make it possible. So there definitely will be opportunities. I think what we need to consider as we are building this out, and I feel comfortable speaking for both Philip and Skyports and Ferrovial, is that we will need to build an initial sort of like a spine of a network, which may not be in every location that you want to be, but then those will allow for operations to begin, for the community to have a say, for other neighborhoods to then address the NIMBY issue, which is like, rather than looking at this as something I don't want, maybe it's something I do want, because it's going to allow me to have a better quality of life, to allow you not to have to be in a car an hour and a half, right? So once that happens and the community gets used to it, then there'll be other nodes that will be natural progression, other neighborhoods that will be added.
Representative Nixon, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. How are you all taking into consideration the shortage of pilots as it relates to the work that you're doing now?
Maybe Ms. Holland, do you want to, I know some of the working group participants included higher education facilities, so I don't know if you want to give voice to some of their thoughts, or if there's another working group member that wants to answer, but I'll recognize you, Ms. Holland.
Chair, thank you. I'm going to actually defer my answer to the OEMs and our industry partners. The FAA does have pilot training and certification, but the generation of that workforce is still being worked through.
Mr. Brofman, I saw a hand raise. You're recognized.
I mean, first of all, we got to acknowledge it's going to be a consistent challenge in the aviation industry until, you know, the realities of the ground change. I will tell you that we have operators specifically and airline partners that I know a few of us are working with that are interested in looking at how this can be a stepping stone to help them close some of the pilot gap. And I won't go through all the nuanced details, but essentially it allows for pilots to be able to fly eVTOL operations as they're gaining some of their hours for the larger commercial jets. Some of this has a lot to depend on, as Ms. Holland has pointed out, how the FAA ultimately decides these type certification processes will work to allow for that to happen, some of the operating rules. But I think we're seeing regional carriers in particular who are struggling with this pilot, but they can use it as a way to get somebody from pilot training school into the commercial jets and keep them engaged. And the other piece that is worth mentioning from a lifestyle perspective and a recruitment perspective is, you know, pilots that are flying, you know, any of our aircraft due to the nature of the mission profiles that we're flying, get to live in and be home almost every single day, right? So you're not flying and having a time where you're in a different city overnight. And so depending on where you're at in your career and what you're looking for, it will hopefully open up the opportunity for people who traditionally wouldn't have considered a career being a pilot. And so those are kind of two paths that we're looking at. And then partnering with the higher education facilities, as Ms. Holland has mentioned, we're very fortunate. One of the, again, attractive things in Florida is the sheer number of pilots that do come out of Florida from our different training academies and training facilities. And I know that there are additional folks looking into how to expand that in Florida as well.
Mr. Asensio, you're recognized.
Thank you. And just to add to what Brofman was saying, we at WISC are working with the FAA to identify how we can operate with autonomy within the current rule set as well, because we believe there will be a transition from this piloted operations to the gradient of autonomy assisting those piloted operations to then full autonomy as well. And so we'll have a supervised autonomy within the instrument flight rule set that we're working with the FAA and NASA in terms of how do we enable that within this next decade and further. So that will also address the shortage, hopefully.
All right, Representative Andrade, I know you've been waiting. You're recognized for a question.
Thanks, Chair. I had two questions, if you don't mind. The first is there any focus or discussion about developing these aircraft and applying them to medevac operations at hospitals?
Mr. Brady, do you want to take? Yep, you're recognized.
Yeah, absolutely. So the answer is yes. The complexity is that of just the hospital systems and the amount of board members and, you know, what is their priority, right? It's saving lives. So the answer is yes, but the complexities of and bureaucracy of hospital systems, both small and large, is something that needs to be overcome, right? And so, you know, we are in discussions with multiple, and it's just a matter of kind of getting everybody on board and understanding, you know, what that phased kind of vertiport development and operational kind of uptick looks like. So it will take some time, but we are absolutely having those discussions across the state.
Ms. Holland, do you recognize?
I just want to add to that. That was a really great example. We do foresee a number of different uses for these aircrafts. So in medical transport, it could be the transportation of patients, staff, organs. It could include courier services, search and rescue. There's agricultural applications, so it could be through crop management and farming, and then also logistics and humanitarian efforts. So there's a lot of potential. I think as we begin in this industry, there's going to be some applications that really come to the forefront first.
For a follow-up, you're recognized.
Thanks. And to that point, I appreciate that. In converting uses almost entirely from a helicopter, in an example like a medevac at a hospital, to a port for these vehicles, are there significant differences in weight requirements for constructing new ports? Are there significant restrictions? I don't know, without looking at the federal regulations, if there's still additional fire safety requirements for fuel storage that might not be needed in y'all's context that are still being held on if you are constructing new ports specifically for these vehicles. And is there a significant difference in the weight between a helicopter and an electric eVTOL?
Ms. Holland, you're recognized.
I'm going to address the landing pads, and then I'll let our OEMs address the vehicle weight. The landing pads and a lot of the helicopter pads right now are designed for general aviation use. The vertiports would be a little bit more structurally larger. So they have accommodations for touchdown and liftoff, final approach and takeoff, and then a safety area. So many of those heliports that we have located right now would not be adequate for these types of vehicles.
Do we want to hear from Joby? Mr. Kevork, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So our aircraft is about 5% lighter than a Model 3 Tesla. So they're fairly light. And that's the idea, is to be able to utilize the existing infrastructure, to be able to land on existing parking structure, roof decks, unutilized spaces, and reimagine how that could be leveraged for a quiet travel. And I think the idea of bringing it in areas, obviously, you traditionally would not bring aviation, because these aircraft, at least for the Joby, is coming in at about 45 decibels in flight, which is inaudible, and 65 decibels at takeoff, which is our conversation level. So I think that's important. Again, there are various types of aircrafts. Beta's got cargo. Lilium's got 6 passengers. We've got 4. But generally, these aircraft are much lighter than you've traditionally anticipated, and much quieter when it comes to the aviation noise profile. And to the question on the piloting as well, which also changes, you know, we are going to require existing pilots or utilize existing pilots and train them up to the additional month or so that's needed for these aircraft, and working with the FAA on what those rules are going to look like. But in terms of that, I think you'll see a lot of OEMs activating and doing community work to build up to that effort. For example, we launched a partnership in New York with Aviation High School, where we're working with them for the next several years on curriculum development, training, et cetera, and inviting students to be a part of our on-the-ground 12-week pilot ground school before they can do the aircraft pilot training, actual flight training. And you'll see that replicated across the country. I'm happy to bring that to Florida and expand with other OEMs as we build those networks, because it's going to take a long cycle, in addition to the existing pilots starting young and building that network of STEM interest academia with the students. So,
And I'd like to recognize Mr. Freeba from Volocopter. I know you have a compelling Medevac life flight case study from Germany before we move
Thank
on.
You. Thank you. Indeed. So we're working in Germany with ADAC Luftrettung, which is the largest helicopter emergency service provider in Europe. That is a very encouraging use case that we're developing here. And one of the reasons why ADAC is working with us is the weight. So the Volocopter is about 900 kilograms, which should equal something like 2,000 pounds. Secondly, they're also much, much cheaper in maintenance, as we don't have engines in that sense, but are based on batteries and less moving parts, thus much, much cheaper in maintenance. About right now, we're calculating 10 to 20% of maintenance costs that ADAC would have for each helicopter also.
All right, Ranking Member, Vice Chair Baker, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was said earlier that we are far behind other countries in regulating and advancing these technologies, and you sort of just spoke to it in Germany. So I just want to get a better understanding, if someone can speak to which countries are these, how are they regulating, are they already operating, how far behind are we?
Ms. Holland, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. I can start the answer. I think there's a few additional folks that are interested in weighing in. So at our Olympics next year, we will actually see a demonstration taking place. Also, last night, I received some news feeds where another country has approved the autonomous travel for these vehicles.
Mr. Brofman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I think to provide some context, I don't know that it would be, I don't want to characterize U.S. as truly behind. I think where we are at is a high level of uncertainty because the rules aren't finalized. And so I think what the Assistant Secretary laid out is 100% correct in her opening remarks around, you know, some of the key rulemaking processes that are just not finalized. The FAA has given the appropriate indication and promises that they will be finalized in time for all the intended operations. And so we are hopeful that the work will be done. But you can imagine that high level of uncertainty makes it challenging for us as OEMs, for FDOT, for communities, right? And so that's really the world that we are in. And if we kind of back up as to why, EASA, which is the FAA equivalent in Europe, began the rulemaking process only slightly earlier than FAA, not significantly so. But the difference is they go through a more collaborative rulemaking process. And so just as in the state of Florida, as we are working through legislation, you know, we're able to collaborate with policymakers. We work with FDOT. It's done in an open format and under sunshine. That is essentially similar to what EASA had gone through, was a really back and forth approach with OEMs, with operators on how this would look, which is different than the process that the FAA goes through around a rulemaking process where they essentially ask the industry, what do you want? There's a feedback opportunity where everyone's presenting. They come back with draft proposed rules. Comments are submitted, and then they essentially are unable to interact with us until the final rules come out. And I'm using some extremes here, but that's essentially the process. And so that's really the challenge. You know, and my colleagues can correct me if I'm wrong, we're encouraged the FAA will allow for the rules very similar to that of that EASA has come out with, that will allow us to operate in, you know, 2024, 2025 as folks want to be able to do, and it will enable the safe operations. But it is that high level of uncertainty that makes it challenging for the Skyports, fair of y'all's of the world to plan, for communities and for the state, which, you know, ultimately the state in some aspects is responsible for implementing some of those safety rules that the FAA needs to put out. And so that's where the challenge comes in.
You're recognized, Mr. Asensio.
Just real quickly, I just wanted to back up what Matt from Lilium said. We're all optimistic that the FAA will play catch up and will be ready for the industry. But I just wanted to mention that's why it's so important what this body is doing for the state of Florida, because the state of Florida is taking a lead. And as soon as FAA plays catch up, the state of Florida will be ready to hit the ground running. So thank you so much for putting so much attention on this.
Representative Harris, you're recognized for a question. And then we'll go Representative Porras and then Bakeson.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, everybody, for visiting us today in this amazing presentation. And I think this is really exciting. And it's always really good to think of other ways to travel, especially when we always talk about the roads and how congested they get. I was reading and I saw that a few years back an agreement was put into place to actually put a vertiport into Lake Nona. I'm not sure what part of Lake Nona, but as a representative of a part of Lake Nona, I did have just a question about emissions. I know that they're EV, but I do know that in order to generate electricity, there are some emissions. And so my first question was, would the electricity be generated at the vertiport, or are these batteries that, like, how are they powered? I know they're EV, but how are they powered? Where is the electricity generated?
I think for this one, we'll do the Lilium Ferrovial partnership and thank then Ms. You. Holland. So Mr. Brofman, you're recognized.
Thanks, Representative. So I think to answer the first part, we could sit down and show you kind of where we're looking at for vertiport options in the Lake Nona area, but we really it's about connecting it with the airport. And we've had great conversations with MCO over the last few years about how to really bring these projects together into one unified Aerotropolis project for the Orlando International Airport. And to answer the other half of the question, all of us, and again, my colleagues will jump in when I get this wrong, but all of us, you know, are planning to charge our aircraft in a very similar way that you charge ground-based vehicles. As a matter of fact, most of us have agreed to use ground vehicle-based charging standard plugs. And so the electricity, for example, like no, will come from OUC. We've worked closely with OUC, Duke, and Florida Power and Light as we kind of think about these networks across Florida, both Skyports, Fair of Y'all, the airports, and they were also part of, I believe, the FDOT working group to really think about how we bring electricity to the right spot at the right time and at reasonable prices. So there'll be no on-site emissions produced. I would say, because I know that the Fair of Y'all and Skyports will jump in if I don't, right? Always, if there's an opportunity to have solar, we'll make sure there's opportunities to have solar to generate electricity, but given the amount of demands, these will be tied into the existing grid, and again, done so in partnership with the utility providers to make sure that it's done in a way that does not disrupt service and that is sustainable long-term for the utility provider.
Thank you. Mr. Tapanas, you're recognized.
I agree with everything that Matt just said. Just wanted to say, as an infrastructure provider, that we are looking to design these to make them sustainable. And although we may not generate enough power to charge the eVTOLs, we are looking to make sure that we can generate power in the facility to light it and to offer all, you know, power for the functions that we'll have there. So definitely will be reduced emissions.
Yeah, we're going to try to follow up.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So, like, visually, so I understand this correctly, the vertiport in Lake Nona, the Lake Nona address is just more so because of the proximity to MCO, and so it's going to be kind of part of that kind of MCO type of campus. Am I getting that correctly?
Ms. Holland, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. The initial location of the Lake Nona spot that you're talking about has actually had to be relocated. And you actually bring up a really great point. When we're looking at site selection, it's so important for us to look at the zoning, the land use, the environmental considerations. The original location would have actually created friction with other commercial jet travel in that landing and takeoff.
Representative Porras, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this innovative presentation. I mean, you guys have done a great job so far. Just wanted to circle back to the discussion we were having about Miami-Dade. I have a huge, you know, airport in my district, Miami Executive Airport, which I think would be a fantastic pilot program, pun intended. And you know, I was just curious what kind of infrastructure we're looking at in some of these smaller airports in comparison to, obviously, the much larger airports like Miami International Airport. And also, you know, two-part question. I'm also very curious about the air cargo. Just realistically speaking, maybe one of the OEMs can answer, how much cargo are we looking at into one of these, you know, vehicles? Are we looking at an entire pallet? You know, someone coming from the supply chain industry, I'm just curious to see realistically how much weight one of these vehicles can carry, considering how the weight of them already being high.
Ms. Worsberg, you're recognized.
Thank you. So yeah, I'm with Beta Technologies, and just first on the airport side of things. So Beta, we are building out charging infrastructure in addition to our aircraft, and one of our primary focuses has been on getting our charging stations at airports. And so far we have primarily been focused on some of the smaller airports. A big part of our goal is to provide connections between these underutilized airports and also just connecting rural communities. So that's a big focus for us. And we've been working really closely with airports and FBOs to get those stations installed. We've been starting to work with various airports in Florida. So far we have one active charger at Duke Air Force Base, but we're in conversations with other airports as well. Side though, as has been said, so Beta's model is a little different from the other OEMs. We are focused on cargo and logistics first, and then we'll be doing passenger down the road. But one of our primary customers is UPS, so they are planning to use our aircraft for those middle mile deliveries to, you know, cut out so much transportation between these bigger hubs and provide more connectivity with these communities. In terms of like what is possible for getting on our aircraft, because UPS is one of our primary customers, we have, you know, really been designing our aircraft to make sure that it is usable for them. And we can fit, I think it's up to about 3 pallets of onto our aircraft. I think one of the bigger challenges these days is less about the actual weight and more just because there are so many packages, it's like getting all of those boxes into a space. But so, you know, we are making our aircraft, our aircraft is designed to support those type of deliveries.
Representative Bankson, you recognize your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just so appreciate the work group. Of course, we were handed legislation from another state that we began to run with last year, but it's important to get it right, not just rush ahead. And as we were able to meet together, waiting, of course, for the FDOT report on this, incredibly helpful to have everyone together at the table. The initial legislation was more focused on a government-funded model. We want to make this private opportunity because you do business better than we do. And so that being said, two questions, if I may. First of all, you had mentioned and referred to the FAA issues. Being a pilot, I get this. Secretary Perdue's letter was a tremendous letter. Did we get any response from the government? I mean, you indicated that there's optimism that we'll move ahead of that 2028. But again, as you mentioned, France is already getting ready to showcase, and we need the federal government to get on the ball for us.
Ms. Holland, you're recognized.
Thank you. And Representative, two really great questions. At this time, we have not received a response. We're eagerly awaiting and open to have those conversations. You bring up some really great points about legislation. And ultimately, as a state, we do want to work to establish the right regulatory framework for us. That can include some key areas that we want to focus on. So it's working to assist those local governments with the training and the outreach. It's also important to look at local ordinances for airport zoning. And then lastly, we want to make sure that the land for these aircrafts is held to the appropriate safety standards.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
And part of the discussion is, again, not to be too verbose in things that are already covered. There's a broad definition for anything that leaves the ground. And so there has been question on that as we've been working together on this about the necessity of including the verbiage for a vertiport specifically. And I'm just wondering, what is the importance of including the vertiport definition in state statute as opposed to it simply being part of the whole? I know that I've gotten a little bit of feedback from the work group, from those, the OEMs, wanting to see more specific language. So finding that right niche there.
I think that's thank you, Chair. Sorry. And Representative, thank you. I think those are also really excellent questions. One of the steps that we're taking right now is to update our airport, airspace, and land use guidebook. So some of that language will be taken up there.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Stark, you're recognized for a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Could the panel answer for me, where are these vehicles manufactured in how many locations?
We've got quite a few OEMs on the line. I think I'll take some privilege and just name them, and if I've left anyone out, perhaps you can weigh in. So we have representative of the working group, which is representative of the industry to date. We've got Germany, France, California, Brazil. Have I missed anyone? Mr. Kevork. California. Joby Aircraft is manufactured in California. Ah, I did it.
Good job. I'm sorry. This is Theo with Beta Technologies. We are also manufacturing our aircraft in Vermont.
Oh, and Archer in Atlanta, Georgia. Waiting for that Florida manufacturer, folks.
Well, that was the point.
members, any other questions? To the panel, I'll take another stab at some questions. You know, we've heard of deployments looking at the United States. We've heard of deployments in California. We've heard of pilot pipeline programs in New York. Could you speak a little bit as to why you're so excited about the Florida market? Mr. Brofman, you're recognized.
And I think I touched a little bit on this before, but I think it's worth stating 100 times. The fact that we are all even here today having this conversation is evidence of the state of Florida, the FDOT, leaning in on this. And really, I say on behalf of the residents of Florida and the businesses in Florida, saying how can we ensure that this industry impacts Florida in the way that we want and that we're supportive of the industry. And so that as a base level is key. I would be remiss if I didn't mention we have fantastic weather in Florida. And so early flights will be visual flight rules. And so it's incredibly beneficial to be in great weather. And then just by the nature of how Florida, quote unquote, kind of grew up from a city to city perspective, it provides both great opportunities for all of the different kind of mission profiles we were talking about, right? So we've got one of the most densely populated cities when we think about Miami. We've also got a state that has transportation challenges, as we all know firsthand, when it comes to connecting cities and connecting within cities. And so those challenges and unfortunately, historically low different modal options, right, that we know we're constantly trying to improve upon, really provides a unique benefit for us to be able to bring AAM here. I want to, you know, highlight the cities that we all work with across Florida have also been very receptive and willing to work with partners like Lilium to think about how this can best impact the city. And then, you know, I think finally, I would say, it's also helpful. We won't be crossing state lines that often as we operate in Florida. And so we're able to operate within one entity. And I would, again, just reiterate, we have seen that continued partnership. The FDOT working group is one of the first working groups that dove in as deep as they did. The reaction that we've had from, you know, the work with Chair McFarland and Representative Bankson on the legislative side and the policy work and really focused on getting this right makes it really a great state for us to be able to make these investments in and launch and work with our operators to launch service in.
Representative Escamani, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you so much, Chair. I just wanted to echo Rep. Stark's question about manufacturing and what would it take, you know, for Florida to maybe play a piece in manufacturing? And I'm also curious if you're working with Florida Makes, as they're one of my favorite organizations. They do such great work in trying to increase Florida's manufacturing footprint.
Mr. Freeba, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just to circle back, yes, we're currently manufacturing in Germany, but looking at places around the world, obviously also the U.S., and what would it take to move parts of the value chain to the US? That's basically the partners that are willing to invest also. I mean, I think all of the companies here of the OEMs are still looking for investments, basically state subsidies also that would incentivize that move. I think one important step in that is for us to showcase actually what is possible. That is why we have this demo flight on November 2nd. You mentioned it at the very beginning, to basically gather all the partners that are needed to move parts of the value chain to the US also.
Ms. Holland, you're recognized.
Representative, your question is so timely. Interestingly, I had a conversation with Florida Makes just yesterday. They have a very important study that's due to the governor by December, and we have provided a number of different reports that we've developed to them so it can be incorporated. Ultimately, their study should be presenting some of our greatest opportunities.
Members, this concludes our committee agenda. We've got just a couple minutes left. I want to thank you again for such a robust discussion. We use our time here in the Transportation and Modal Subcommittee, so thank you for being here, and thank you for bringing your A-game today. Moving forward for next steps, I've asked Representative Bankson to take the lead on our Committee for Advanced Air Mobility Legislation. As he mentioned, he's working very closely with DOT and the working group members, and what we hope to see is codifying some of the recommendations that have come from the working group, whether it's definitions or zoning, or to put Florida in a receiving posture for when FAA does conclude their certifications that Florida is ready to take flight. So I hope that this has birthed the love of advanced air mobility, or at least a curiosity for many of you. If you want to help in the effort or weigh in on additional ideas, again, Representative Bankson is our lead. He's a pilot and has showed great interest in this issue from last session. But I'll make sure that my Marine pilot keeps an eye out
for what he works on here, and Representative Smith. Members, thank you again so much. See no further business before the committee. Representative Harris moves, we rise. The meeting is adjourned.